This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
We've had seismic changes in the last decade, and we've adapted to them. But what comes next?
We really talk about autonomous business processes rather than just automating business processes.
I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Our latest episode explores how to build a digital brain and future-proof your business. Vision to Value on Resilient Edge is available now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Most travelers stick to the highlights. But in Turkey, if you go off the beaten path, you'll experience a whole lot of adventure. Like the St. Paul Trail, where cyclists chase the thrill. Or Urla, where you can kitesurf to your heart's content. For exploring on your feet, hike up to Mount Nemrut. Or walk in Patara, through ancient civilizations that might reveal the history of humanity itself. Plan your detour at goturkey.com for a gripping adventure.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Imagine they've just made you Foreign Secretary or put you in charge of health policy. Who are you going to call? Time is short, but here in The Briefing Room, in just 28 minutes, the top experts will fill you in. This week, we've had the Russia report and the row with China. Where next for British diplomacy? Here's how it looks. We don't like Russia. We're increasingly dismayed by China. We're out of the EU. And we're faced with potentially two very different versions of the American alliance after November's presidential election. It's a challenging time for British diplomacy, but at least we have a slogan.
Global Britain.
Global Britain.
Global Britain.
Global Britain is open for business.
So what does Global Britain mean? And what challenges does it face? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, I'm joined by the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, to tell us how foreign affairs have come back into such sharp focus.
British foreign policy is in transition at the moment. So in recent weeks, we've seen the British government adopting a much more robust stance on China. It has criticised Hong Kong security laws. It has offered settlement to millions of Hong Kongers with British passports. It's criticised China's treatment of the Uyghur minority. It has banned Huawei, the Chinese tech company, from the UK. We've also seen, secondly, the imposition of what are called the Magnitsky sanctions on individuals in Russia and Saudi Arabia, a couple in Myanmar, for alleged human rights abuses. And I think the third event that we've seen in recent weeks in terms of British policy overseas is it's decided to merge the Foreign Office and the International Development Department. So those are some of the trends that we've seen in recent weeks. And it's given us quite an indication as to some of the thinking that's going on at the moment. First of all, this desire within the government to have a more joined up foreign policy. Secondly, I think a genuine sense of trying to say, look, does the UK have a role as a sort of defender of international rules and rights. That is beginning to emerge. But also, I think, fundamentally, we've also seen that UK is still open to substantive pressure from the United States, which has driven a substantial amount of this policy, particularly the more robust stance on China.
I seem to recall that when he was Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson talked a lot about something called Global Britain. Is this what's happening in the last few weeks, what Global Britain means, or was it something else?
The problem is that it was a great phrase, Global Britain, but nobody ever actually said what it would mean in practice. And so many people said, look, this is just a slogan that's sort of still in pursuit of a policy. So as a result, it's meant in the vacuum, people have imposed their own views of what it is. So some people say, it should mean that the UK would be, Singapore on Thames, a low tax, low regulating country. Others say, no, it should be, just a buccaneering trading nation. Others say it should be Empire 2.0, depending on what vision you have. Critics thought that the phrase was sort of slightly presumptuous. It even had a sort of imperial tone, this idea of Global Britain that didn't sort of reflect the UK's real status today. So essentially, Global Britain is saying, look, how does the UK mobilise its strengths to promote its interests? It has a unique set of institutional power bases and skills. So, you know, it's a member of NATO, the UK's permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. It's in the G7, the G20. It has its Commonwealth relationships. It's part of the Five Eyes intelligence group. It has substantial soft power in terms of tech in English, the BBC. It has a pretty effective deployable military. It's the sixth largest economy in the world. We are the second largest aid budget in the world. How does the UK use that better to promote its national interests? That's the question. The problem is that no one yet has come up with a definitive answer.
Now, one of the concrete changes you've talked about was the merging of the International Development Department inside the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, and as they put it, to have a more joined-up policy. What does that actually mean?
The thinking behind it is to say, look, Britain spends a huge amount of money on its aid, £15 billion every year, and the argument is that it's a bit diffuse, and no one knows precisely what it's all been spent on, and that you have contradictions, of which the biggest contradiction is clearly Saudi Arabia. So we sell arms to Saudi Arabia. The problem is some of these weapons are used in the conflict in Yemen, and then a substantial amount of British aid is spent picking up the pieces, giving the money to the aid agencies that are dealing with the consequences of that awful conflict. How do you square those circles? Is it possible to have a more integrated sense that British aid has been spent in the right way? That's the argument for it. What the critics say is that you're actually going to dilute Britain's soft power strength as an aid superpower.
James Landale on the immediate context. Next, I want to understand where we're coming from. Lord Ricketts was head of the diplomatic service, representative to NATO, was chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee and ambassador to France.
When I look back over my career, there have been two guiding principles that you could say amount to a kind of national strategy. One, Britain at the heart of Europe. I joined the Foreign Office just after we joined the European Community, as it then was. And the other, the closest ally of the US.
Let's talk about that relationship with the United States. What were the assumptions and dangers that we saw in the developing relationship with the US? What were we trying to achieve and what were we guarding against?
I think Britain's always had a very strong sense that America is the critical strategic ally in the Cold War, balancing off the nuclear power of the Soviet Union, but also the power that made things happen elsewhere in the world as well. Whenever there was a crisis somewhere, it was usually when the Americans decided to put their shoulder to the wheel that progress was made. And because we had the wartime relationship with America, that continued into the Cold War, and all the prime ministers I served with, I think, saw that as absolutely crucial. Not always, of course, willing to bend the knee to the Americans. I remember Margaret Thatcher sometimes, you know, having quite a difficult and testy relationship with Ronald Reagan, but always counting in Washington and always taking account of the American view before we decided our foreign policy anywhere in the world.
And what worried us about what might happen in terms of US policy?
In the Cold War, we were worried that in the end, the Americans might decide that European security was not their absolutely number one priority. And I think that growing sense that Europe at some point would have to take on more of the responsibility themselves was always in the back of people's minds in policymaking.
And how did we understand our role in creating that European responsibility?
For many years, London saw any European role in defence as undermining NATO and risking inviting the Americans to leave. And for a long time, there was no defence dimension to Europe at all. It was really when Tony Blair came to power. He wanted Britain to be at the heart of Europe. He liked working with Jacques Chirac in Paris. He understood that if the Americans were going to continue their commitment to European security, they had to see the Europeans doing more. And starting in Bosnia and in Kosovo, British and French forces took on a large share of the burden. And in the end, Britain did a bit of a U-turn and became a country that was in favour of developing a European defence capacity. Britain became more active in seeking a stronger European defence. It really came apart in the Iraq War and the bitterness of the divisions within Europe. And since then, British policy has tacked back towards being very wary of Europe having its own defence capacity and wanting to put all the emphasis on NATO as the foundation stone of our security.
Now, that was the defence dimension of cooperation with Europe. What about the foreign policy dimension of cooperation with Europe?
Increasingly, Britain saw Europe, the European Union, as an amplifier for our foreign policy ideas. That was already clear under Margaret Thatcher. It was even clearer under Tony Blair, who had a long spell in office, spent a great deal of time working the European as well as the international network, and saw the EU as a natural way of Britain multiplying the impact of our ideas. There are only two countries in Europe that had a real global view, and that one was Britain, the other was France. So Britain could often bring an idea into the EU, secure EU backing for it, and then go out to operate it with the clout that that backing from the European Union brought. If we could make common cause with the French as well, then we were on to a winner.
So how much unilateral weight did we have, or did we try and use our unilateral weight mostly through multilateral institutions?
Most of the prime ministers I worked for were clear that Britain acting alone in the world had much less influence than Britain acting through its various multilateral partnerships, EU and NATO in particular, but also the UN Security Council when that was functioning. From time to time, could take effective and forceful action on the world on its own. Falklands invasion was obviously one. The last great set piece diplomatic negotiation that Britain has held, the handover of Hong Kong to China, but they've been relatively rare even in the last 40 years.
Now let's look at some of the difficulties and difficult countries that we've had to deal with. In particular, let's look at the evolution during the time you were a diplomat of our relationships with Russia, where after the fall of the wall, we thought for a while we had a partner and then possibly discovered that we didn't.
Yes. Mrs. Thatcher was very early on to the possibilities of Gorbachev, which was the first Western leader really to make a relationship with him. And when Gorbachev came to power, there was a moment of opportunity where it looked possible to work with Russia as a partner in dealing with the world's problems. That soured fairly quickly, and we failed to see eye to eye really in the Balkans, and certainly not over Iraq. And by the time Vladimir Putin came to power, again, Tony Blair had a shot at forming a cooperative relationship with him. For a year or two, that seemed to be working. But again, quite quickly, the Russian tendency to regard the West as the generational adversary, to see discord and division in the West as in their interest, came back to the fore. And that was brought home to all of us dramatically and very tragically with the assassination of Mr. Litvinenko on the streets of London in 2006. There were certainly no more illusions about Russia after that.
How seriously, though, would we regard Russia as a threat?
I mean, Russia is a declining power with a weak economy but strong military forces and a grievance against the West so big you can see it from space. And in my experience, certainly in the last 10 or 15 years, has purely been a destructive country.
You have particular experience, as you've mentioned, with dealing with China. How has our understanding of China evolved?
Britain probably has known China better than any other Western power because of the intense engagement over Hong Kong, really over 15 years of continuous negotiation. And that did lead to a period, I think, of mutual confidence, of a degree of trust in the Chinese side. They were amazed that in the end we kept our word and handed over Hong Kong to China as a going concern with all the assets, with the gold bars in the bank.
You mean they were expecting us to asset strip the place and leave it, scorched earth?
They were mirror imaging, I think, because I guess that's what they would have done in reverse circumstances. And I think they suspected we'd take all the money, we'd saddle them with vast debts, and they didn't trust us at all until the very last moment when they found that everything was intact. And that did, I think, give Britain and China a certain rapport and mutual understanding, which lasted for the best part of 20 years. That's now all totally changed.
Let's say I'm a new questing foreign secretary and I've asked you for advice. And my first question to you is, Peter, what should keep me awake at night?
I think, foreign secretary, you come into office at an extraordinary time for Britain. I see ahead in the next few months three watershed moments which are going to shape British national security, national strategy for the next decade or two. One, of course, is the end of our relationship with the EU and the need to invent a new one. Secondly, is the US presidential election and what direction America takes after that. And thirdly, it's the post-COVID world where we need to reinvent multilateralism. Multilateral institutions haven't had a good show during the COVID crisis, but Britain needs a rules-based order where we can trade peacefully and where we can have some say over the rules that govern the world.
Lord Ricketts. Let's look a little more closely at that supposedly stable pillar of British foreign policy, the relationship with America. Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri leads the US and America's programme at the international relations think tank Chatham House.
Britain is certainly respected by American diplomats. We know the strength of the relationship when it comes to intelligence and the understanding that, you know, this relationship is deep and has multiple layers, cultural, historical, political, economic. But when it comes to concrete, specific influence on a given area of foreign policy, I think it's fair to say Britain has ceased to have very clear influence over the biggest issues of the day.
So when the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was here this week, was he here to listen or was he here to tell?
I think Secretary Pompeo was here to talk about that US-UK trade deal, but undoubtedly to make it very clear that the US is unambiguous in the line that it's taking on China now, and especially on this question of 5G.
Now, what is the quid pro quo that Britain can expect for such a policy? America wants us to do something. Does it have to give us anything in return?
Britain is clearly very concerned about what the US-UK free trade deal will look like when we get there. That's obviously not happening before the November election. If we see a new administration, if we see Vice President Biden elected president, the US is going to be saying, we're going to give you a trade deal that looks closer to what you would like to have, but we're going to expect something in return.
Is it possible to say that a Biden administration, if that's what happens after November, therefore next January, would listen more to Britain than the Trump administration has done?
Of course, we expect a Biden administration to be much more friendly towards Europe, towards the UK. But there are a couple of caveats there. One is, if you go back to President Obama when Joe Biden was vice president, this was not an administration that wanted to see Britain leave Europe. So there's a difference of view with the current UK government. And this is also an administration, if Joe Biden is elected president, that will be looking for the United Kingdom to get on board its agenda. And I think if Britain looks the other way, that will come at a price.
Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri. So we have a sense of Britain's place in the world. But what next? Christopher Hill is Emeritus Professor of International Relations at Cambridge University and has written a book on British foreign policy after Brexit. And Dr. Victoria Honeyman is a politics lecturer and specialist in British foreign policy at the University of Leeds. Victoria Honeyman, let's start with Russia. What do you think should be the objectives of British foreign policy when it comes to Russia?
I think that the United Kingdom would like to attempt to rein in Russia. It would certainly like to try and mitigate some of the damaging impacts of Russia upon, for example, as we've learned from the Intelligence and Security Committee's report on our democracy. But realistically, the United Kingdom is bound because it simply is not a superpower. It simply isn't a large state that can make Russia bend to its will.
So is it your impression that there's nothing very useful that Britain can do about Russia on its own?
There are certain things that the United Kingdom can do and have done, such as sanctions, for example, upon key individuals in Russia. But realistically, it is difficult to see how those can have a long-lasting, sustained effect upon the Russian political set. So I think that the United Kingdom would be looking for multilateral action with other bigger players, such as the United States, in order to make sure that they themselves were not left out in the cold.
Does the same apply essentially to China?
They are huge funders. They are huge investors in the United Kingdom. And therefore, I think that that is a bigger problem for the British government. There's also the issue of how can you fight a nation that's even bigger than Russia, not in a physical sense, not in a military sense, perhaps, but in a more influential sense.
Christopher Hill, how are we to go about achieving our objectives
concerning either of those two countries?
I mean, we at the moment consider Russia as an adversary, but we do not yet regard China as an adversary. And we've got a big choice to make there. Do we want to follow along the lines being pushed by Washington and see China as the major threat to us and to the international system in general? Or do we want to maintain some kind of practical relationship, keep channels of communication and economic life open with that country? We need to distinguish between the kinds of objectives we want to serve. Do we want to try to compete with Russia and China on the wider international scene, the Middle East, the Far East, and so on? Or do we see ourselves as more a regional power in defensive mode?
Victoria Hanneman, what we're focusing quite strongly on is the fact that Britain is a medium-sized actor on the world stage, and that the emphasis is naturally going to be upon coalitions and bridge building. In practice, what does that mean that we have to do?
I think that you're right in that Britain is a medium-sized country. The issue is, do we necessarily recognise that as fully as we might do? The British psyche about foreign policy has often had what, you know, Douglas Hurd referred to as kind of the punching above our weight idea. It entirely depends on what we want to do, because we don't necessarily have the capability to do all of the things that we may wish to do. You know, we don't necessarily have the armed forces to be able to engage in certain action. Do we really want to be a nation, particularly in the post-Iraq era, who is going around the world attempting to impose our will on nations, whether we are right or whether we are wrong, knowing the financial costs that come with that and the political costs that come with that?
Ever since 1945, there have been periodic agonizing reappraisals about Britain's role in the world, especially after 1968, the withdrawal from East of Suez, joining the EU, leaving the EU, and so on. But the thing that has been most evident has been the continuity of our outlook, the idea that we do actually have a special position in the world by virtue of our history, by virtue of our reputation, and that we can act as a sort of pivot, words that Blair and others have used, or a bridge, that we can somehow uniquely bind together different groups. Now, if you think about the most obvious role in that respect, the famous bridge between Europe and the United States, which Britain aspired to and in some respects played, that is surely going to be rather more difficult now that we are out of the European Union. We cannot pretend to speak for Europe as a whole. We are still an important European power, as long as we prepare to think of ourselves as European still. But we are inevitably trying to take a more individualist line, and we may be pushed more, as I think Victoria is hinting, back towards a closeness with the United States. What is going to be very difficult for us to maintain, I think, is what an Italian colleague of mine, Marta Dassù, has called Anglo-nostalgia, this idea that it is built into the habit and furniture of our minds that we are a great power with unique capacities in international relations. And I think that's rather sad. I think that Britain really, as many people have said over the years, ought to come to terms a bit more with the limitations of its power, and then it will be able to play its cards rather more effectively.
The one big push in the post-EU world for us, given the uncertainty of our trade relations, will be to prioritise trade as a part of foreign policy. In other words, to try and get on as well as possible with anybody, effectively, who can make a bit of money for us or who we can trade better with.
One could break off relations with a country which one disapproved fundamentally, whether because of its own internal immorality or because it had done something aggressive to Britain. But that is pretty unlikely to happen. That is the sort of nuclear option, because you're causing yourself enormous problems most of the time by doing it. On the other hand, it doesn't follow that we, in order to achieve certain fashionable and important trade deals, we have to butter up the countries with whom we're doing business. We can regard it simply as a practical matter in which we can have our own national interests. The other country we're negotiating with will do a deal. That's how something like the World Trade Organization operates. Well, it doesn't operate at the moment, it's stymied. But still, in general, international trade negotiations are pretty hard-headed business. Clearly, Mr. Cameron thought that he had to give President Xi the golden coach ride through London, the drink in the pub in the Cotswolds and all the rest of it. You don't have to do that if at the same time you're very and understandably concerned about the fate of the people of Hong Kong. Equally, it doesn't follow that you cut off all relations with that country because of those concerns.
One tangible foreign policy decision, Victoria Hanneman, that we have made is to bring together the Foreign Office and the International Aid Department. What do you think that tells us about government thinking?
There's been a bit of a hokey-cokey, one foot in, one foot out, as far as DFID is concerned. So the department in some format has existed since the 1960s, and initially it was independent, then it was in the Foreign Office, then it was pulled out and created as its own independent department by the Blair government. And if you read the documentation from when DFID was established and the white papers that followed it, certainly through to the early 2000s, you will hear about improving people's lives, about, you know, decreasing mortality rates, increasing the number of children that are in schools, those kind of very traditional aid agendas. However, over time, that has adapted, and certainly under the Conservative government, certainly from the Green Paper before they were even in power, there was this movement to a more strategic approach to DFID funding, that perhaps you might be able to utilise DFID funding in order to not just improve the lives of people in the developing world, but in order to improve Britain's trading links, in order to improve Britain's strategic position. And I think that the move of DFID into the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is exactly that. It is the kind of the blooming of that policy.
But wasn't it a big thing to be able to claim about Britain that our aid budget was based on the needs of the people to whom it was directed rather than our own selfish requirements?
It was hugely important. It allowed Britain to create an identity for itself of being an international good guy, a nation that was interested in building solid relationships that were based upon more than singularly trade. It was to pull us into new arenas, to allow us to have a voice in the decision-making in those arenas. And I think that the decision that has been taken, not only will it chip away at that position, but it also, it's, in terms of optics, it's not a good look.
Now, I want to ask you both a final question. Imagining for a moment that somebody's been foolish enough to appoint me to the Foreign Office. And I want to know, essentially, what I should do to best lever Britain's position in the world in the next few years.
We need to pick our battles, and that will inevitably mean working closely with other nations. Those other nations, whether it be Germany, the United States, members of the Commonwealth, they're not always going to agree with us. They won't always give us what we want. So I think that we have to work hard to build those relationships, and we have to try to stop seeing some of our closest international allies as a kind of us and them.
Christopher, can we just dig into that last point? We want to persuade other people to help us achieve our objectives. What is it that we have to do to maximise our capacity to do that?
Now, at the moment, Britain says under the present government, post-Brexit, that we can pick and choose, that we can pick to create new coalitions on an issue-based foundation, and then we can leave them in order to move on to another one. Well, that's obviously true in the sense that we're no longer part of the EU's network and institutional commitments. But it would be very foolish of us, I think, to do as the government is currently doing, refusing even to talk about a systematic institutional agreement with the EU of coordination over foreign policy, because we're bound to work with France very closely as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. And therefore, we're going to be tied in, whether we like it or not, to the broad lines of what the EU is going to do. Now, given that the United Nations is less important than the EU, but it's a framework within which we operate, we will also have to be reaching out to poorer countries, to countries in different regions of the world. But we'll have to make judgments about which regions we can actually have any significant influence in.
Christopher Hill there, and Victoria Hanneman, and my thanks also to James Landale, Lord Ricketts, and Leslie Vinjamuri. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirstine Knight, Simon Coates, and Joe Kent. It was mixed by James Beard, and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including on China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang, how to negotiate a trade deal, and how local lockdowns could be used to combat the spread of coronavirus. You can find them all and much more on BBC Sounds.
Kann eine Karriere neugierig sein? Komm zu EY und erlebe es selbst. Arbeite an spannenden Projekten, gestalte die Wirtschaft von morgen und entwickle dich auch selbst weiter. Im Team Assurance, Tax, Consulting oder EY Parthenon, Strategy and Transactions. Shape your future with confidence. Jetzt bewerben auf jobsgermany.ey.com.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just a cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.